I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the legendary composers in the American theater and popular song joins me now. Maury Yeston has just released a new album, Maury Sings Yeston, The Demos. It has 40 tracks of Mr. Yeston singing and playing his own compositions from his award-winning scores of 9, based on Fellini's 8.5, Titanic, and his production of Death Takes a Holiday, an unproduced show, Queen of Basin Street, based on the French film La Cage aux Folles, the concept album Goya, which was commissioned by and written for Placido Domingo, and other pop songs and theatrical works in progress. These demos are fascinating because they're often recordings made just after Yeston has written its music and lyrics. Some have been overhauled or worked on, but they are terrific insights into the writing process. I'll get Mr. Yeston to talk about how he works and the rich material that's on this album. Maury Yeston is a composer, lyricist, author, and teacher. He is the winner of 2 Tony Awards for Best Score for 9 and Titanic. He received an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Song in 2010 for Take It All, a song he wrote for the film version of 9 starring Daniel Day-Lewis, which was directed by Rob Marshall. He was also nominated for a Tony Award for the score of Grand Hotel the Musical. His score for Phantom remains very popular. It's a show produced in the United States and around the world. It was a show that was created before that other one by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Visit MauryYeston.com for more information. This new album is from PS Classics and is now available through the various digital and streaming platforms. A 2-CD set will be released in December. Visit PSClassics.com for information on that. Mr. Yeston joined me earlier this week from New York City. It was such a delight to talk to someone whose music I've been listening to for years, whose work I've admired. Incidentally, he celebrated his 75th birthday last week. He indulged me in many great stories from his life and career. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Maury Yeston. Mr. Yeston, good morning.
Good morning. Call me Maury, by the way. I will do that,
and happy birthday, Maury.
Thank you so much.
This just seems like a great time to put out this album. I mean, you're 75, and it's a great way to view your work, but it's also, you know, a lot of us can't get to the theater. I'm wondering, what have these last eight or nine months been like for you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, first, thanks for the birthday wishes. And, you know, it was the man who created the PS Classics, the label, was one of my students at Yale when he was a freshman. Mm. And I educated a whole generation of musical theater people from there. And he's produced a lot of my recordings. And he actually, his name is Tommy Krasker, he actually got the job of being the rehearsal pianist in the very first production of 9, starting with the workshop. So he's known all about my creative process, and he's heard all of these songs just as I had written them over the years, and so he shared with me, I guess, that very special feeling when you've just created a song, and I've always had a habit of recording it, either privately or going into a studio, because I don't think I can evaluate the song when I'm hearing myself sing it, so always like to sort of, you know, look in a mirror and make a recording of it. And some of the recordings are very complex because starting back in the 70s, you know, like the Beatles, we could, you know, record ourselves over and over again, multi-tracked.
Yeah.
And so over the years I've made, because a lot of the things that I write for musical theater are choral in nature, you know, I've recorded myself a number of times so I could hear what the full version of the song is going to be like. So this group of singers, me, has come to be known as the Maury Tabernacle Choir. So in answer to your question, Tommy felt he's known all these demos, and he thinks a lot of them, and I've taught a whole generation of musical theater writers here in New York how to write, and they've all gone on to win their Tony Awards. And so I thought, part of the creative process and the history of how these things come to be can be interesting. And if Tommy wanted to put that out, and if people would be interested, I'm all for it. By the way, it's also a very economical model because they've all been recorded already.
Yeah.
but they're a lot of fun, and they're informative, and I think they capture some of the joy of making the discovery as a writer when you've first written it.
Yeah.
and so many of them have survived in various forms into, you know, appearing on the Broadway stage in the ultimate shows that they came into. So the timing felt right. And then, of course, just the idea of there's no new shows putting out cast albums now, and it's just, I feel so fortunate to be able to put out there, you know, a new album.
Yeah.
And also to make work for the people who design it and remix it and things like that. Those of us in New York and in the West End, and I'm sure in theater all over the country, are doing everything we can to support the infrastructure, the artists, the designers, the music copyists, anyway, the actors, any way we can during this very difficult time.
Did it take a lot of convincing to put it on an album? Because for a writer, I mean, these are sort of first drafts, if you will. They're very different than what we've eventually heard in the show or on the official cast album.
Yeah, they are, and I think the reason that we didn't have have too much doubt about it was because they're very polished, a lot of them. Mm. I guess maybe because I'm a schooled composer, my piano arrangements are very full and actually have guided the orchestrations of them, so I have a sort of orchestral feeling on the piano, and the choral work actually has a way of helping out, so that you're not just hearing an individual voice, but you're really hearing sort of, it sounds like it has the energy of a show.
Mm-hmm.
I love to hear my friends. I've loved to hear somebody like Marvin Hamlisch play his song.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get a kind of information from the person who wrote it playing it that you don't get from somebody else singing the song, and I think there's that too. So no, we didn't have, as I wrote in a note, if I'm hoping that seeing this as the process will encourage all new young writers in this field to persist. If you've done what you think is a wonderful first step on your song, stay with it, and it'll ultimately come to fruition. And here's an example of, let's say, a song like Unusual Way or a song like New Words or some of the things that I've written over the years that have become extremely well-known and performed very often. You know, this is what it was 3 days after I wrote it, and I went into a studio or turned on my home tape recorder and played it. And look what happened. So let that encourage you.
I can't see how this is not useful for writers of music and lyrics. I mean, you mentioned this idea of persisting. Writing is rewriting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In fact, that's exactly the phrase I used in my notes to this album. The art of writing is the art of rewriting. It's exactly right.
Yeah.
And and some of the examples of it are very, very interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with Titanic, the musical.
Right.
But in that one, the idea was that I would write a number for the captain's table that would portray all the richest people in the world. What was the art that they were looking at? Picasso. Who were the composers? Oh, they had just seen, a film star. And what were the most expensive hotels they stayed at? Because they were the first class. And, what's going on in the world? A fellow just invented, just flew an airplane across the country, and somebody else invented a material called cellophane. You could see right through it, and all of those things. And I wrote the number, and it was called Sitting at the Captain's Table. And we went into rehearsal with that, but when we did, we realized, Peter Stone and I, the book writer, realized this is an opportunity while they're singing this number to show a number of people, the owner of the ship, trying to encourage the captain to go faster and break the speed record, this is one of the things that led to the crash. And so, ultimately, I wrote a different number called What a Remarkable Age This Is. And so, here's an example of somebody who knows the show very well. We'll see that, actually, that was not the first number that was put in the show. And they're equally good numbers, I think, but the second one, the one that ended up in the show, has a function telling the story and creating the suspense and the drama far more than the first one. And so it's a kind of a lesson in why you rewrite.
Yeah. The other thing that's impressed me about your work, and we hear this on the album, is that the influence of very different kinds of music. There's an English influence, say, in Titanic. The sound in Nine is different than Grand Hotel, and Queen of Basin Street is awfully different than Club Moscow on this album. You listen widely. Is that important? And I guess that's a lesson for writers, isn't it?
I not only listen widely. You know, I speak English and pretty good French and pretty good Italian, and because of my PhD, I studied German, and because I do so much work, I've got some Japanese and even some Korean. And I and Hebrew, and I find as a musicologist, my PhD is in music theory, but that it's important to speak all these musical contexts, whether it's Mozart or Dizzy Gillespie or African drumming or American folk music. And so I find that when you create a show, you're creating a world. The world of Nine is obviously the northern Italy and upper-class Italian and visiting Europeans. The world of Titanic is absolutely the English at the turn, at the height of the British Empire, and with Vaughan Williams and Gilbert and Sullivan and that whole world, and every Grand Hotel, you're in Germany in 1929, and so I tend to create musically and paint musically the world of that the music and the musical style creates a world unique to that show, and so you really are in, because I'm a jazz historian, you know, you really are in the Queen of Basin Street, which takes place, and you really are in that world of music, which is radically different from Spanish music in Goya, and so that's definitely part of, I think, kind of the way I write. I like a show to be a world into itself, you know. And I find that my heroes also did that. You know, Frank Lesser really wanted to write the equivalent of an opera in Most Happy Fella, and he created this Italo-American sort of operatic score, unlike Guys and Dolls. Guys and Dolls, these fabulous jazz New York wise guys, but he creates this whole other world of them, the Most Happy Fella, in that, and I admire that so much, and I guess I aspire to doing that in my own work.
I'm not going to ask you which comes first, the music or the lyrics, because I'm sure you're asked that all the time.
Well, no, but there's a great Cole Porter story about that.
Yeah.
Cole Porter was asked the question, which comes first, Mr. Porter, the music and the lyrics, and he said the check.
but I'm wondering, Maury.
Sometimes you get a phrase right away, and it's music and lyrics. If you do both. Sometimes you sit down and you write a lyric because sometimes you just pop out or inspired by a tune. So it can be everything. But I will say, once you're working on it, you're doing it all at once. Even if it's a team working together, they're working at it all at once. You know, Howard Ashman directed the staged reading of Nine at the O'Neill Foundation when I had first completed it. And at the end of the summer, he said to me, you know, I write lyrics and I'm looking for a composer. And I said, well, you have to meet my friend Alan Menken. And I assure you, Alan and Howard, just, you know, everybody did everything when you're working together. But sometimes, though, you really do get just a great idea, you know, a tune comes into your head. Paul McCartney very famously tells this story, and actually he told me we had dressing rooms next to each other for an event in New York, and he told me, and I'm sure he's told a lot of other people, that he woke up one morning with Yesterday in his head, and he called his father and he sang it to him, and he said what did I steal this from? It sounds so familiar, and his father said, Paul, I think this sounds, you know, sometimes you come up with something that just sounds like it's been around forever, even though it's brand new.
Yeah.
And then he famously McCartney also tells the story that he didn't have a lyric for it yet, so he invented what we call a dummy lyric. And the dummy lyric was scrambled eggs. Scrambled eggs, oh baby, how I love your legs. I really love your scrambled. And Pratt lived with that for about 2 weeks until he finally wrote the lyric.
Yeah. But how often have you found yourself writing for a specific actor or actress as opposed to a character?
That's a great idea when you have one. So if you're writing simply, you know, in limbo when you're writing the show, that's one thing. But once you have somebody on stage, that is when you most specifically have an opportunity to write a song for that person who is everything that they are. They're creating the character, and I've done that, and it's the best possible time, because the more you can define what I like to call the assignment,
yeah,
right? A perfect example, there's a number called Folie Bergère in 9,
mm-hmm,
and I wrote it for Lillian Montevecchi, and actually I wrote it the day after I met her. Lillian Montevecchi was a wonderful French performer. And she auditioned for us, and nobody ever said that she could even sing, but I thought she was so wonderful, she could play the French producer, even though it was a non-singing role. And so the first day of rehearsal, I asked every woman in the cast to come to the piano and sing a little something for me, because that night I was going to write the overture. I was going to treat them as an orchestra. And I didn't ask Lillian, because she was a non-singing role. But I thought, oh, you know, I can't leave her out like that. So I said, Lillian, come on, come sing me something. So, of course, she came over to the piano, and she sang, la, 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 la. She sang La Vie en Rose, and it was like listening to Piaf. So that night, in the hotel room at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I thought, why can't I write her just a little, just a soup song, just a little French ditty. She'll remember with sentimentality the Folie Bergère. And so I was at the piano, and I just wrote, you know, Folie Bergère, la musique de la danse. Anyway, I called Tommy Toon in the morning, and I said, look, don't tell her, but I'm writing a little something. He said, well, let me hear it. So I played it for him over the phone. I said, but not a word, please, because I may change my mind about this. So naturally, when I got to rehearsal, I was at the piano, and this person came behind me and said into my ear, darling, is it true for me you're writing for me a song? But in any case, I did write that song. We expanded it. It became a huge number, and she won Best Featured Actress in a Musical at the Tonys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having done that song, so there's an example of, and in fact, another great example is when I was called up to Boston to doctor a show called Grand Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It was in trouble, and they needed some rewriting, and it was all hands on deck. And it's a brilliant Broadway tenor, a legendary man named David Carroll, and I wrote him a song called "Love Can't Happen," because there he was, and also the great Michael Jeter needed a song, and I wrote him a song called "From the Hospital" for Grand Hotel, and Michael won the Tony for that, and it was the best possible assignment, because I had them right in front of me to write a song for. Jane Krakowski was in that show, and she was 17 years old, and she needed a song, and I wrote a song called "I Want to Go to Hollywood."
Right.
And so your question is a great question, because very often when you have the actual person there, you really can hone in on what are their best notes, what can they do, and you don't have to wonder. You're right there with them. So that's also sort of a wonderful opportunity. Many wonderful discoveries are made when you're in trouble in preview.
Yeah,
I can tell you one very famous story is that that's apparently, when funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, and they started showing the opening previews, and there was Jerry Robbins and Stephen Sondheim and Hal Prince, and apparently the audience wasn't laughing. And so the legend is that they were sitting and having notes, and somebody said, you know, we have to figure out some way that, you know, we have to find out some way of telling the audience that this is supposed to be a comedy. So I actually was a very close friend of Larry Gelbart. He and I wrote a show together, and he had written the book for that. So I asked him, I said, Larry, this is the legendary story. Is this what happened? And Larry said, well, almost. He said what happened was is that Hal wanted to give Steve a note, but he note to Jerry Robbins so that Jerry could give him the note. And on the note, he had written, "Tonight a comedy." And then Robbins apparently said to Sondheim, "You know, Steve, we need to find out some way that we're going to have a comedy tonight." So according to the story, and I think probably true, you know, Sondheim, the great Sondheim, came back with an opening number named Comedy Tonight.
Yeah.
And told the people, "You have permission to laugh." and you know, that's very important. You have to have that if you want to have a comedy.
Well, when you, by the way, do you still teach?
Yes,
yeah.
I do.
Is it important for you, like, to teach writers of musicals, for example? Because I'm sure you have a lot of people who seek your advice,
well,
your knowledge.
I was the director of undergraduate musical studies at Yale when I was teaching there full time. I taught some very brilliant people, and I'm a music theorist, and I have academic books I publish with Yale Press. But in addition to that, I have a lot of irons in the fire. But I also, as a young person, as a graduate student, participated in Lehman Engel's BMI Music Theater Workshop. Mm-hmm. Next to me was Alan Menken, Howard Ashman, Ed Kleban. And when Lehman died, I took over and taught that class for 25 years. And my students there were Aaronson Flaherty and Marks and Lopez and Bobby and Kristen Anderson and Kit and Yorkie. And I watched them write their first drafts of Next to Normal, Avenue Q, in that class. And, you know, teaching is really a matter of providing an atmosphere in which people can get from the class the rarest commodity in the world, friendly criticism.
Yeah.
I'm scheduled to do a Zoom class for the BMI Music Theater Workshop next week for all the young writers. And I find that teaching is one of the things that when you feed, it feeds you back.
And it's not just theory and structure and music that you're teaching. It's these anecdotes, these stories of things you've heard, right?
And you listen to a song and you say, I'm not sure you're reaching the goal of that song, and let's talk about it. And Ned Roram, the great American composer, in his diaries wrote the most wonderful line. He wrote, "Artists exult in their own self-discovery, but teachers exult in the self-discovery of others." And I think that's true. I think it's really true that you to have such fulfillment in having a hand in helping somebody develop themselves. But then, of course, probably the best telegram I ever got was from a former student. And it was the night that I won the Tony Award for Nine the Musical. And he sent me a telegram. And the telegram said, "Teachers can."
Oh, that's a great. Incidentally, there are no songs on this album from Grand Hotel, and I understand.
And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the booklet, the reason there are no songs from Grand Hotel was because I wrote the whole thing in 10 days in a hotel room in Boston.
And it's amazing. You mentioned the songs, you know, "Love Can't Happen," "From the Hospital," "I Want to Go to Hollywood." Come out of such an intense time.
Because you have everything before you, and you can diagnose and say, "Oh, I see the problem," and then you define an assignment. And when you define the assignment, you know, the assignment is make Jane Krakowski tell you that she wants to be a film star, and she wants to go to Hollywood. But the trouble with that moment was that Tommy and the authors had not told the audience the fact that outside of this hotel, people are bringing money in wheelbarrows to stores just to buy a loaf of bread.
Mm.
And they're miserable out there. And so I looked into the novel, and there was a description of what Jane's character, Flemshin, this little secretary, she was living in poverty in a cold water flat. And so what I did was I created another section of the song inside the song.
Right.
That said, "I want to go to Hollywood so I can get far away from Friedrichstrasse, my awful apartment." And so that told the audience that Grand Hotel was a lot of rich people living in pre-Nazi Germany, which was in which the Deutschmarks was worth virtually nothing, mm-hmm. and people were suffering terribly. And so by doing that, the song wasn't about going to Hollywood so much as it was about getting out of this awful place where I am now. Yeah. And so I never would have come up with an idea like that if not for the fact that I was in a show in Grand Hotel and there are things that had to be told to the audience. And so, you know, that's fine. I do find often that you do your best work when you're in trouble out of town. Or yeah. or in my case, I've never had that opportunity. Everything I've ever previewed has been on Broadway yeah. with the worst rumors in the world swirling around town.
Yeah, especially with Titanic.
Yeah, that's right. But that again, that was an example of we simply went straight ahead and did our work. And that also, I think most of the shows I write, I've had the idea for the show. It was my idea to write Titanic. It was my idea to write Nine. Mm-hmm. And so there's something very personal about it. But I think that one of the things that I think the best thing that you can probably hear in this album is how close you are, because most of these things I recorded a day or two or 3 days after I'd actually finished writing it.
Yeah.
And so there is in it a kind of ebullience and joy of
yeah.
discovery,
yeah.
you know, and also there's no way I could have known when I had done that it was going to make it to the stage. And yet there's something in it, some ineffable quality that made me feel, once I was able to record it and then hear it as an audience, that, you know what, this is a keeper. I'm going to go with this,
yeah.
you know, in my first draft. I think this should be in the score. And I guess history has proved a lot of it right.
Yeah, like New Words, for example, is a beautiful song that's taken a life of its own outside of the context of this project you were working
yeah.
with Larry Gelbart.
When
you hear that again, the recording on the album, the demo, I guess there's no way to imagine how that all turned out, is there?
Well, you know, I'll tell you the story about New Words is so interesting. My little boy was about one and a half or two,
mm-hmm.
and our teacher Lehman Engel was very distressed because the people in the class weren't bringing in enough new songs all the time. So he gave the class an assignment, and the assignment was, I want you to come in next week. I want you to write a song that begins by describing an inanimate object and take it somewhere. And driving back to Connecticut, to New Haven, where Yale was from New York, I saw this full moon, and I was thinking about my little boy who was just learning his first words. And I realized, since he goes to bed early, he won't know any night words. And I got the idea for the song, and in that case, even though I had a melodic idea in my head, I pulled over to the shoulder and wrote out most of that lyric, and then wrote the song. The next Monday, I brought the song in, and everybody played their new song, and I did not play that song because I was embarrassed, and I thought that everybody would think that rather than just doing the assignment, I had written some mushy, over-sentimental song about my new baby.
Mm.
And so when the class was over, Lehman Engel, the teacher, went off to the men's room, and my friend Alan Menken said, why didn't you write a song? And I said, well, I did, but I'm embarrassed to play. He said, well, play it for me. So I played him the song, and when I finished playing the song, there were tears coming down his face.
Yeah.
And Lehman came back in, and he said, Lehman, you have to hear this song. And he made me play Lehman the song. And you know, that's how that happened. You know,
yeah.
I very often, I have a email relationship with Stephen Sondheim. We know each other, and that he keeps telling me that's one of his favorite songs.
Yeah.
And, that's just a song that, from things autobiographical, plus I was writing a show about a father who has a child, everything just came together. And you don't write a song like that every day, but that recording of that song is, I recorded it the day after I wrote it,
yeah.
before I'd even played it for anybody. And so it's a treasured memory for me.
And it's been recorded many times. I mean, you mentioned Sondheim.
Yes,
he put that on the list of songs that he wished he wrote.
Yes, he's analyzed it. His feeling is that the critical line in that song that he thinks is one of his favorite lines, he's very, very complimentary about it, is the line, "It gets harder."
Mm.
You know, it's so hard to say, my son, it gets harder. And it does for all of us, doesn't it? So that's a very meaningful song for me, and I'm so glad I had recorded it, and
yeah.
I'm so glad that so many years later, you know, now by the way, that little boy is now 47.
was Grand Hotel the first time you worked with Peter Stone?
Peter and I had known each other for years, and had been good friends. We collaborated together in running up to save my one and only.
Mm.
It wasn't doing well, so Peter and I and Mike Nichols ran up, and you know, and spitballed. Peter, you know, made some changes in the book, and we all just were there to coach. But then we were both called up to Grand Hotel, and for Grand Hotel, that's when we literally worked together. He was helping with the book, and I was helping with the score. And when we were done, Peter said to me, "Well, what are you writing next?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing Titanic. I've been writing it for 3 years." And he said, "Well, you know, that's my show." I said, "Well, no, it's not, Peter. It's my show." He said, "Yeah, but I really want to write it with you."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, I couldn't be more thrilled." And we got to work writing Titanic together.
I can't imagine what it was like to work with him because he was such a wit and clever.
He's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And we had wonderful times. It was very, 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 very intensive work. We used to meet about twice a week in the same Chinese restaurant on 2nd Avenue near 72nd Street. And I'll tell you how intensive it works. It was one day, and Peter said, "Well, we'll have Chinese again, and we'll go over the second act." I said, "Right." And so we walked into the restaurant. We sat down. The waiter came over, and Peter looked at the waiter later. Didn't even look at the waiter. He was looking at the script we were working on, and he said, "You know, I just want the beef and the peppers, please, but no onions." And the waiter looked at him like he was crazy. And he said, "Sir, this is an Indian restaurant." And what had happened was that they had sold the restaurant. There were white tablecloths on it. The Chinese restaurant never had white tablecloths.
Yeah.
Neither Peter nor I noticed. It was a completely Indian. It was lamb rogan josh.
Yeah.
And naan. We didn't look at the menu. There was Indian music playing, and neither of us noticed. That restaurant had been sold, and that's how intensely we worked on Titanic.
Yeah. There was a moment, I guess, during all the travails of that show where you're all wondering what to do, and he says, "Well, what do they usually do? They bring us in, right?"
Well, actually, was my line.
Oh, was it your line?
We were really down in the dumps. We were really down in the dumps, and the opening was like 3.5 weeks away, and I looked at Peter, and of course, you know, we had fixed My One and Only, we had fixed Grand, and I said, "Look, Peter, if this wasn't our show, and we had to call somebody in to fix it, who would we call?"
Yeah.
And Peter said, "Us." and so we set about doing it. Peter was a wonderful wit, but also a very, very bright man and very well schooled. You know, very a student of American history. Which is why he did such a brilliant job with 1776.
Yeah.
By the way, my favorite story,
yeah.
My favorite story about that show is that
yeah.
apparently one day in London, somebody came up to the box office and said, "I'd like a pair of tickets to 1776, please."
That's great. And then you worked with Larry Gelbart, who I mentioned a moment ago. I mean, you must have had so many laughs.
He is absolutely. The great thing about Larry is that, you know, everybody, some people write jokes. But
uh-huh.
Larry is all about words, right? You know, I'm afraid happiness can never be ours. Well, we'll just have to learn to be happy without it. I mean, that's quintessential Larry Gelbart. But he was funny in life. He well he told me a great story. Carl Reiner, he and Carl were best friends,
yeah.
And the wives were best friends. And apparently Estelle, Carl's wife, wanted to spread her wings and do it, you know, go into a saloon, be a saloon singer, right?
Uh-huh.
Go into a cabaret. And so Carl told Larry, he said, look, Estelle's going to sing a set at such and such a club next Tuesday, and you and Pat have to come and support us. And so Larry and Pat Gilbert came, and they're sitting there, and Estelle came out and sang a set and got a big hand and walked off stage. And Reiner looked at Gilbert and said, so what do you think? And Larry said, I can see that love is deaf, too. he just had that gift.
he just had
that gift. And I'll tell you the truth, you know, musical theater, it's so hard.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, you know, you really know when you've come up with something, if there's you really recognize when there's even a kernel of an idea in something you've written that's worth working on it, and working on it and working on it and getting it right. And everybody I know who has done these things, whether it's Stephen Sondheim or Larry Gelbart or Peter Stone or Alan Menken, you really do work very hard to get it right. Sometimes, like jumping out of the head of Zeus, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can be whole, but it really is about work, and it's about craft. And you know, when we say, as you say, the art of writing is the art of rewriting, it really is true. And so I find that, that would be demonstrated in, you know, these 40 demos.
Yeah.
Because the song had to carry expository weight that came from the book. I changed them so that they could do that or rewrote them. And so it's a wonderful craft. And, of course, you're interacting with actors at the same time. And so as soon as an actor comes in who has a high C,
yeah.
Well, then you're going to rewrite your song that has a high C.
Yeah.
You know? And I've certainly done that, actually, for Placido Domingo.
Right.
When I wrote Goya for him. And so I think this album shows you that. I'm hoping that this album inspires every new writer to persist.
Yeah.
Not to give up. To have a version of something that, you know what, maybe it's 80% of what you want, and just keep working on it so you can make it 95%.
You mentioned Goya, and the song that from that group that I just love, and I've been listening to now a couple times since I've listened to the whole album, is I Will Paint the Sound.
Yes.
And it says a lot, I think, not just about what the project was about, but it says something about you and the work you've done over the years.
Yeah, you know, that's what I do. You know, as a composer, because I'm a complete composer, I write orchestral music. You know, I wrote a concerto that Yo-Yo Ma premiered. I love how all music, whether it's film music or whether it's Richard Strauss or whether it's jazz, how music paints a story and a world all by itself. And I try to do that in my work and create a musical world. And so here's Goya, who's very much the same person that Beethoven is. He had great passion for democratic principles and the French and American revolutions, and here's Goya who went deaf in the middle of his career, and he was apparently deeply in love with a woman, the Duchess of Alba, and I thought, how can he express his love to her? Well, even though he can't hear the sounds, his mode is his poetry, his ability to communicate is through his art, and I thought, he'll paint the sounds for her, and that's how I got the idea of the lyric and wrote that song. It's one of my favorite songs,
yeah,
of my own because of that. Because the ability to break through being deaf and to be able to find a way of singing through the art that you can do, through painting, we'll do anything to communicate to each other. And, you know, musical theater is a perfect example of that. You know, it's such an interesting hybrid form. And that's one of my very favorite songs for that reason. It's very gratifying to me that you enjoy it.
I mean, you think of the set for Nine, for example, in the original production. You literally painted the set, right?
That's right. Tommy said to me, "Yes, in Europe is in the music. We don't need a set. You make us see it."
Yeah.
And it is that truly is the case. You know, I at the beginning of this at the opening of the second act, when Claudia and Guido are on the beach, I wrote chords that came in and out like the slow waves of the ocean coming in and going out. And we wrote one line. Arthur wrote one line. "Why did you bring me to this beach, Guido?" And the combination of that line and the music, the producers saved $300,000 in not having to buy any sand.
Right.
You know, and it's incredibly poetic moment. So, yeah, I think that's very important. I love and have written tone poems, you know, where Richard Strauss can show you Don Quixote and also the songs of Schumann and Schubert, who have the piano be a character and paint the drama for you and paint the, you know, whether it's a father on horseback holding his little child rushing to the doctor, you know, in one Schubert song, and he has the piano create that image with music. And so I find that very, very singularly important to me in my work, that the music have that capacity to do that.
I want to ask you,
that's why there's so many different worlds on this album.
And indeed, yeah, the variety of music is just wonderful to hear. I wanted to ask about the film version of Nine. There were a lot of songs that were cut, and you of course, added songs, songs specifically for the film. I've always thought that the title song, Nine, was such a pretty song.
Well, not only that, it's the meaning of the whole show, which is that the man's stunted, and he's an emotionally child of nine, and because of that, he's just running riot through these brilliant women.
Yeah,
and he's got to learn how to grow up. So when the suggestion was that there would be a film of Nine, my agent said something very smart. She said, "You know, John Updike had a novel, and he gave them the rights, and they did the film." And somebody said to him, "Well, how do you feel about what they did to your book?" And he said, "They didn't do anything to my book."
Yeah.
And that, therefore, I told Rob Marshall, I said, "Look, Federico Fellini gave me his permission and the rights to take his brilliant film, 8½, and make it a musical. And God knows, I changed. What didn't I? What did I even keep?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I made it my own. And so I respect you. I respect your talent. And so far as I'm concerned, if you do what you need to do to make this a film. Otherwise we'll just put this film on a stage and aim a camera at it."
Yeah.
And so he did what he wanted to do, and I wrote anything he wanted me to write, and a couple of things got nominated, and, you know, I liked the film. Some people didn't care for it because they liked what the show was, but it was my job to give him the freedom to do what he thought, as an artist, was his vision.
Yeah.
So, but you know, for me, I think you're right. I think it would have been better if they had sung that song.
Yeah.
But I don't criticize it, because I think what he found in his vision was something, a different take on the story and a different take on the character. And I think Daniel Day-Lewis is an extraordinary actor, and I think he gave us a brilliant alternative to what Raul Julia had created, and to what Antonio and Banderas had created on stage. And, you know, and I think the next person who's going to do Guido is going to redefine Guido again. I'm very happy that my work has the elasticity to accommodate, you know, great people doing these things, because without all those people, I'm dots on a page. and my demos.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, you just mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis and Raul Julia. I just, you know, I mean, there was a lot of criticism when the movie came out that Lewis was not Italian, but Julia wasn't either. I guess was Sergio Franchi the only one
he came in just to replace.
Yeah.
But no, but you see, but when Tommy and I were doing Nine, I said, look, I want every woman who's going to audition for us, I want each woman to audition with two songs. One, whatever song shows her best, to best advantage, mm-hmm. and two, a song in a European language. Because I wanted to feel Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy said, and as we were auditioning people for Guido, and every single one was, you know, like shucks, Will, from Oklahoma. You know, chorus boys from the Midwest, and none of them felt European and Italian. And Tommy said, for Guido, we need an actor who is going to be other. And when he thought of Raul, Raul is not Italian, but he's Hispanic, and he is other. He is, there's uniquely and authentically that otherness that's just not an American actor from the Midwest. And you know, When David Laveau did Nine in Buenos Aires, there was a tango star named Juan D'Artes, and he was extraordinary in the same way. And so when Antonio came along, I knew that magic would hold true for him, that he would just be somebody from another place. He's a blue-collar kid from Malaga, and he brought that to the table and brought that into the picture.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think Daniel was such an extraordinary actor that he created a level of complexity about the character that for me was breathtaking. I think he's just, you know, a genius.
Yeah, it's a great film. I saw it recently, and I saw things that I hadn't seen the first time.
You know, he had retired from acting.
Mm.
And Harvey Weinstein had to go find him, and Daniel was living in Florence learning how to be a shoemaker. I didn't make that up.
Yeah.
And then he was convinced to take the role with Rob. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a wonderful experience for me, because you know Nine is just as much about the incredibly gifted women who put up with this man and who nurture him, as it is about the main character.
Indeed.
And to have Sophia Loren and Marion Cotillard and Penelope Cruz and Nicole Kidman, and I mean, really, and Judi Dench,
right,
was just, you know, the most extraordinary experience.
Yeah.
You know? And you can just imagine sitting at lunch with all of them. You don't say very much.
One of my favorite songs that you've done, and I listen to it probably once a week, is Love Can't Happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's from Grand Hotel.
Yeah.
And that was an impossible and unbelievable situation for which nothing can be written because it defies credulity, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Lillian Montevecchi at the time was in her late 50s. She plays an aging, over-the-hill ballerina. David Carroll, one of the most handsome, magnificent tenors in the history of Broadway, was probably about 29 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing a baron. While she's on stage, he has sneaked into her hotel room, and he's stealing her diamond necklace. And she catches him. And she says, "What are you doing in my room?" And he says, "I'm here to breathe the air that you breathe." That's what was written.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow he's supposed to sing this love song. Well, it's impossible.
Yeah.
There's no way that's going to work. That, you know, she's 50-something, he's 29. Also, she's stealing. And what kind of a line is, I've come to breathe the air that you breathe? And so I was sitting with Peter, and I said, "Peter, I think when she says that line, I think the only thing that we can do here is when she says, 'What are you doing in my room?' and he says, 'I've come to breathe the air that you breathe,' I think she should pick up the phone and say, you have 30 seconds to come up with another line or I'm calling the police.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, one of the things that if you have a problem in musical theater, very often the best thing to do is to write a song about it. Because, you see, love can't happen. Love is always very unlikely. But then, out of nowhere, like a miracle, it has happened.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that you do as a technique, as a way of understanding the emotion of a moment, is you deny the moment. And by denying it assertively, you actually arrive at its opposite. Here's a perfect example. I hate men, right? But she loves the guy. She loves the guy. And so I realized that David's singing, when he said, I've come to breathe the air that you breathe, come up with a better line, and I wrote the intro, which is, Mademoiselle, I followed you everywhere. He's not telling her he loves her. He's showing her he loves her. And it's always better to show than to tell. London, Vienna, Paris, I've admired you, hoping one day we might meet in this way. I never thought I'd be carried this way, because love can't happen.
Yeah.
But it has happened. And then she comes into the song as well and sings, at this stage in my life, this is the last thing that's possible. But it happened. And so that's my favorite part. That's my favorite kind of song to write. I had both actors in front of me. I had an impossible situation. And the way to solve it was simply to deny the possibility of what was going to happen. And yet it does.
Yeah.
And then the melody carries that. And it's a very soaring melody. And, you know, I'm sorry I haven't got a demo for that,
but I literally
sang it to both of them the morning after I wrote it, and we put it in the show two days later.
Yeah, and it stopped the show, didn't it? It just
Oh my God, yes, every single time.
Yeah.
And David was nominated for a Tony.
Yeah. And the review that they did I guess in March, that album is out now, and I heard.
Oh, yeah. Anything Can Happen in the Theater.
Yeah.
And that young man does it, Ben Eakley, he does a splendid job.
Oh, yeah, just a tremendous. Yeah.
He really does.
It's a beautiful song. Maury, I have just enjoyed speaking with you. And,
well, it's been delightful to talk to you. Thank you so much. You've been so kind in helping me help people hear my work. I deeply appreciate it.
It's a beautiful album of demos, and I can't thank you enough for your time, and happy birthday again.
Well, thanks very much. And I wish you good health and safe travels.
The album is called Maury Sings Yeston, the demos. It is from PS Classics. Visit MauryYeston.com and PSClassics.com for more information. Maury Yeston joined me on the line from New York City. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.